loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, we address the dueling rallies in Texas last night, one led by President Trump and one by Beto O'Rourke. And there is an initial proposal to keep the government open while funding ends this Friday. Next, we turn to the smear against Representative Ilhan Omar in Congress. Then, American-allied Syrian forces are battling ISIS extremists in their last stronghold in the country as the debate over the future of U.S. troops there rages. And then, today, we continue our weekly segment dealing with the ongoing militarization of space. And finally, a dozen leaders of Catalonia's failed 2017 independence bid have gone on trial in Madrid on charges that include rebellion and sedition. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Joaquin El Chapo Guzman was found guilty on all counts today in a federal New York courtroom. Guzman is a notorious drug lord who played a major role in the violence fueled by the drug trade in Mexico. El Chapo faces a mandatory sentence of life without parole. The Taliban announced the members of a new negotiating team that will participate in upcoming talks with the United States. The negotiators include five people who had been held at the prison in Guantanamo Bay, as well as a member of the Haqqani Network, seen by the United States as a terrorist group. Recent negotiations have made significant progress as the United States looks to wind down its nearly two-decade-long military presence in Afghanistan. West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin has announced that he will vote in favor of the confirmation of Attorney General nominee William Barr. Barr had previously served as Attorney General under George H.W. Bush, where he pursued policies that expanded mass incarceration. Manchin is a Democrat, but frequently votes with Republicans. Cliff Sims, a former White House aide who wrote the new book Team of Vipers, is suing President Trump. The Trump campaign recently filed an arbitration claim against Sims on the basis of a non-disclosure agreement he signed, and Sims alleges that this represents an effort to crack down on his First Amendment rights. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the state of Texas and the president's border wall. President Trump held a rally in El Paso, Texas yesterday that was meant to pressure congressional negotiators into funding his border wall, but things didn't work out the way he had expected. First, negotiators came to an agreement in principle to fund the government beyond Friday without any input at all from the president and without money for a wall. And then his rally was dwarfed in size by a competing rally a half a mile away, led by possible Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke. We're joined from New York by Juan Carlos Ruiz, co-founder of the New Sanctuary Movement. Welcome back, Juan Carlos.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I just read an article just a few minutes ago in Politico, Juan Carlos, that says that the president is not happy with this agreement on the budget, which then has led Democrats to say that they won. Again, there is no money for a wall per se, but there is something like $1.7 billion for whatever they're calling it today, a fence, a barrier of some sort. And the Democrats did give in on the categories of people who can be detained by ICE. What do you think of this compromise? Is this a victory for one side or the other, or is this a genuine compromise?
We have to understand that there are no check and balances any longer in this detention and deportation policy. You know, given the state of affairs in our country, we have to look into the, you know, waste of money and the cost in terms of, you know, the human rights violations that the immigrant communities are really suffering. You know, we need to talk about comprehensive, humane solutions to this. We have in place a virtual wall already, a virtual wall that is funded by billions of dollars, that is part of a security state, violent security system, you know, that frames every immigrant as a suspect at best. So we need to talk about, you know, a different approach. It isn't working. We know that those who really want to harm this nation, if they want to do so, they are not going to cross the border. They have resources enough to do something else, you know, from digging tunnels through the border to doing something, you know, coming on visa or on a visa here to this country. So if you really want to talk about security, you know, let's have more meaningful, realistic conversation. By just putting up a wall, that's not going to solve anything.
What the Washington Post is saying is $1.375 billion for 55 miles of fencing along the border. And that's compared with $5.7 billion that Trump had sought for 200 miles of actual concrete wall or steel slats. The deal omits a strict new cap that Democrats had sought on immigrants detained within the United States as opposed to at the border. But the president appears to be of two minds on this thing. In Politico and The Hill newspaper today, he told reporters, and this is the quote, "I can't say I'm happy. I can't say I'm thrilled." That's him talking about the deal. But we've got a clip of him saying something completely different at his rally last night. Let's go to that.
Last week, I was honored to stand in the House chamber to deliver the State of the Union. And I asked both parties to come together to choose greatness for America. Since taking office 2 years ago, our economy is now the hottest economy anywhere on earth. Our military, which desperately needed funding, we went $700 billion and $716 billion, is more powerful than ever before. That was not a good situation. It was tired and depleted. Our great warriors were not taken care of. Now they're taken care of again the way they should be. And America is winning again. Isn't that nice?
None of this has anything whatsoever to do with the issue at hand. The whole point of going to Texas was to talk about his wall and his request for funding. It's as though he knew things weren't going his way and he was going to just go for the applause lines. Now, a half a mile away, Beto O'Rourke, who, believe me, looked like a presidential candidate last night, addressed the issues that are dividing the country and specifically dividing the country down there along the border. Let's listen to what he had to say.
Here in the largest binational community in the Western Hemisphere. 2.5 million people from two countries speaking two languages with two cultures and two histories who come together, are joined, not separated by the Rio Grande River, forming something far greater and more powerful than the sum of people or the sum of our parts. We have so much to give, so much to show the rest of the country, and we're doing it right now.
The state police, what do they call them? The Texas Rangers say that Beto O'Rourke's rally just dwarfed the president's rally in size. And it seems like the president, Juan Carlos, is losing the public relations battle on this issue. What do you think?
When you are undermining security in general, because I think this by shutting down partially the government, that's at the end of the day, that's what's happening, you know, with the TSA people in the airports not being able to work or having limited resources and really inflicting a lot of suffering on many, you know, thousands of people. I think at the long run, I think that, you know, it's a recipe for disaster. And what we are, he's basically undermining what he is upholding to be his, goal in terms of beefing up the security, having, these security checks on point. And I think, it's the misallocation of resources is, we need to call his bluff. A lot of the stuff that he is spewing, out of his mouth, it's a bunch of lies. You know, we know that the border it's permeable. You know, there are the flow of people, of humanity, they come and go. But we know that right now there is a trickle of the people that in days past, in years past, that are coming through, you know. There is security at the border. I don't know, you know, who is he responding to? Does he have any deals with any contractors, with any security contractors? Because as it is, you know, the technology, the border patrol presence, they seem to be doing a good job in terms of holding back this flow of, immigrants at our doors. I think what I take from this is that we really need to come to the table and talk about security. What does it look like? What's meaningful for us? What's realistic for us? And what's a humane way of dealing with this flow of humanity? Let's talk about real solutions. Let's not talk about fake solutions.
Juan Carlos Ruiz, in our last 30 seconds or so, where do we go from here? Is this problem now pushed off for another year until it's time to come up with another budget? Or is this going to be a continuing fight, whether it's on Capitol Hill or down south along the border?
I think it's a moral imperative of all of us, of people of good conscience, you know, civil society, you know, the politicians. I mean, you know, we have been graced by women now, you know, being, you know, a great number now, a part of the Congress. I think they have, you know, the sensibility and the common sense of, you know, bringing to the table solutions. I hope they are not pushed. Many of our communities, immigrant communities, and many of our, you know, just the people in general, we, you know, because it's a misallocation of resources. It's a wasting of resources. You know, when you talk about a military budget over $700 billion a year, you know, why are we fighting? I mean, you know, why are we in so many places? Why this thirst of policing the world? You know, we need to question that kind of power.
And I think it's incumbent upon all of us. We'll leave it there. We were joined from New York by Juan Carlos Ruiz, co-founder of the New Sanctuary Movement. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Ilhan Omar is a freshman congresswoman from Minnesota. She's one of the first two Muslim women elected to Congress, and she's the body's first Somali-American and first refugee. She's a strong supporter of self-determination for the Palestinian people. And last week, she tweeted lightheartedly that much U.S. support for Israel is a result of money injected into politics by AIPAC, the American-Israel Political Action Committee. The condemnation was swift and strong. Omar apologized immediately and unreservedly. But what did she say that was wrong? We're joined from Washington by Dan Cohen. He's a journalist and a documentary filmmaker, most recently of the film Killing Gaza. Welcome back, Dan.
Good to be with you guys.
Dan, when I first read Ilhan Omar's tweets, I took them to be lighthearted. There was a music emoji. She talked about Franklin's, referring to $100 bills or Benjamin's, whatever the heck it was. I just didn't, it didn't register to me as being controversial. Apparently it was very controversial, and the Democratic leadership in the House came down on her like a ton of bricks. She resisted an apology for about a day and then came out and said that she was apologizing unreservedly, that she had been educated by some of her colleagues on the evils of anti-Semitism. Did you read anything anti-Semitic in her texts, or are we going too far on this whole thing?
No, this is a totally manufactured controversy. There's nothing anti-Semitic, nothing remotely controversial about what Congresswoman tweeted. I mean, she said AIPAC, she basically said AIPAC pays money to Congress in order to bolster support for Israel. And that is it's just absolutely true. That's not controversial at all. So, you know, what we're seeing is a smear campaign that's not only racist and Islamophobic, but is not only coming from the Republican Party, which has no shortage of anti-Semites. I mean, we saw Steve Scalise condemn her for, you know, her for anti-Semitism. I mean, this is a guy who appeared at before a bunch of white supremacists and neo-Nazi rally and said, "I'm like David Duke without the baggage." Not only do we see this from a Republican Party, but also from the establishment inside the Democratic Party, with Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi leading the way. And it really just goes to show the stranglehold, the massive influence that AIPAC has on American politics. And I think the central irony of this entire manufactured controversy is the idea that AIPAC, which is a lobbying group, is equals Jews, is an anti-Semitic concept in itself. And it shows that the political class doesn't actually care about Jews or anti-Semitism, and it will only exploit it to further their political ambitions.
I agree completely. You know, when I joined the Senate Foreign Relations Committee staff back in 2009, I had only been on the job, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks, and I got an invitation from AIPAC to take an all-expenses-paid trip to Israel. I declined. They didn't like the declination, and they offered the trip again two more times in the next 6 months. This is something that AIPAC does with staff members all across Capitol Hill on a variety of committees, whether it's the Armed Services Committees, the Intelligence Committees, the Foreign Affairs or Foreign Relations Committees. Everybody gets a free trip to Israel because that's what they do. They're a lobbying group. Their job is to influence members of Congress. And I didn't see Ilhan Omar's tweets as anything more than an acknowledgement that that's the raison d'etre of AIPAC. That's what they do. I want to read also a quote from Tom Friedman, the grossly overrated columnist for the New York Times. He says here, and he wrote this several months ago. He says, "I sure hope that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu understands that the standing ovation he got in Congress this year was not for his politics. That ovation was bought and paid for by the Israel lobby. The real test is, what would happen if Bibi tried to speak at, let's say, the University of Wisconsin? My guess is that many students would boycott him, and many Jewish students would stay away, not because they're hostile, but because they're confused." Do you see that as being substantively different?
No. You know, I'm so glad you read this, John, because guess what? Thomas Friedman can say this, but this woman, this black woman, one of the few progressives who's in the freshman class in Congress, mm-hmm. She says it, and all the Democrats and all the Republican leaders get up and say, "This was so hurtful to Jewish people." Again, as Dan Cohen is saying, other people can say it, and they're not accused of anti-Semitism. And again, it's anti-Semitic on their part, because guess what? A lot of Jewish people, perhaps the majority of young Jewish Americans, actually don't agree with AIPAC, don't agree with Netanyahu, and would like to have less of its influence in the halls of Congress, trying to criminalize those who are standing for the just cause of the Palestinian people.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Brian. I mean, we should also, you know, consider the fact that AIPAC, not only does it not represent, Jews as a whole, as if, you know, there's one single Jewish entity, but also it's much of AIPAC's support and ideological support in the United States. It comes from Christian evangelicals who actually have anti-Semitic ideas about Jews all returning to the Holy Land before the rapture, in which they'll all die. And this is, you know, part of who Israel and Zionists have made common cause with to, you know, show their support for Israel. And I think one of the key lessons that we need to look to the UK, where there's been very similar manufactured anti-Semitism controversy in the Labour Party run against the opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn, and there's no evidence that he's ever been anti-Semitic. He's actually an anti-racist activist and organizer who's been on the ground for a long time. And because of his support for Palestinian rights and his opposition to selling, you know, military equipment for Israel to bombard Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank, that's why he's under attack. And that's why Congresswoman Omar is under attack here. So I think this, you know, what we saw is the opening shot of what's going to be a long-term campaign through the election season to stifle the kind of insurgent wing of the Democratic Party. And we've also seen a lot of calls, not only We've seen a lot of calls from the Republican Party in particular, and President Trump even, who's made anti-Semitic comments, to have Congresswoman Omar step down, removed from the Foreign Affairs Committee. So this is, you know, I think this is really a political operation that is exploiting anti-Semitism in order to protect Israel. And we've seen it again, and we need to learn from it.
We're speaking with Dan Cohen from Washington. He's a journalist and documentary filmmaker, most recently of the film Killing Gaza. Dan, you touched on something that I think is very important. We've got about 2 minutes left. I want to know your opinion on how you think this is going to affect this freshman class of Democrats, and especially the progressives who came into this freshman class of Democrats.
This is about keeping them inside the establishment. I mean, one of the really notable aspects of this, there's been no solidarity for Ilhan Omar from her fellow, you know, progressive congresswomen like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Rashida Tlaib. Both have left Ilhan Omar out to dry. They were totally silent as this, you know, hate campaign, this racist campaign to silence her was being waged. And it really speaks volumes about the political pressure that the Israel lobby is able to create in Washington and the influence that it has, not only in the Republican Party, but in the Democratic Party as well.
Yeah, he's right. This is a racist campaign against this woman. And by the way, what they're doing basically is taking the well-known fascist anti-Semitic line that rich Jews control the world and trying to say that's what she was saying when she was talking about the undue influence that AIPAC has with members of Congress.
Which is nonsense.
Which is different. That's different. That's not anti-Semitism. That's telling the truth about the Israeli lobby. And the Israeli lobby itself brags about its immense influence, just like Thomas Friedman acknowledged. But Dan Cohen's right.
Yeah.
This is an attempt to shut down and shut up all of the progressive people who want to do anything, the smallest thing in support of Palestine.
And it's because the Republicans are afraid. Not just the Republicans. Republicans and
all the leaders of the Democrats.
They're afraid. They're afraid of this new young wave of activist progressives and where it's going to lead policy.
They're going to crush them if they can. And
guys, I think it's really important that you know, people take this opportunity to learn about the Israel lobby's influence in the U.S. There's an incredible documentary series that Al Jazeera did, and then its Qatari owners actually censored in order to appease Israel. And it's called The Israel Lobby, and there's a series about the U.K., which was released, and then one about the Israel lobby in the U.S., which was actually leaked. So if you just go on YouTube and look up the Israel lobby documentary, it's an incredible four-part series that shows exactly how the sausage is made here. And I think it should be, you know, required viewing for anyone who wants to know more about this subject.
We'll leave it on that note. We were joined from Washington by Dan Cohen. Dan's a journalist and a documentary filmmaker, most recently of the film Killing Gaza. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. The Defense Department announced this morning that U.S. fighter jets attacked a mosque in eastern Syria that was being used as an ISIS control center as American allied Syrian forces battled the extremists in their last stronghold in the country. We're joined from the U.K. by Ambassador Peter Ford. He's the former U.K. ambassador to Syria. Welcome back, Ambassador.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Ambassador, this is getting a lot of play here in the United States, and it's not just this. There are several other developments. One was the apparent death of more than a dozen civilians yesterday in a U.S. airstrike, and then news this morning that the Israelis had launched a rocket attack on southwestern Syria. Can you tell us what's happening across the country today?
Well, with regard to the ISIS situation, ISIS are indeed in their last redoubt, small village called Bahjouz, I think, close to the border with Iraq, close to the Euphrates River. It's just a village, but in it are holding out several hundred ISIS fighters, the last of the last and the worst of the worst. These are probably mostly foreign fighters. The rest have been able to melt away, to reintegrate into civilian populations. But the foreign fighters are obviously less able to do that. And these are the holdouts. And yes, indeed, they, like the so-called rebels from all the armed groups, they have been using mosques, hospitals, schools as command and control centers. But of course, when Assad bombs these command and control centers, it's a humanitarian outrage. It's an atrocity. But of course, the coalition can do it. And that's just an accident. Bad luck if they hit civilians.
And there's no irony in the press. I mean, just as an aside, I was thinking the same thing when I was reading the Associated Press reports this morning. There's not even a mention of the irony of the double standard that you just spoke of. I wanted to ask you another question, too. There's a report today saying that, as you just noted, almost all of these several hundred ISIS fighters are foreign fighters. Almost none of them are Syrian. They're in this place, this village, Baghouz. They're also in the surrounding area, but there aren't many of them. And they're holed up in places like mosques and schools. They are going out to initiate suicide car bombs, sniper fire at Syrian opposition troops, and setting up booby traps. They're using civilians as human shields, slowing what is being described as the U.S.-backed fighters' advance. That hasn't stopped the United States from bombing the area. Syrian state media reported this morning that U.S. airstrikes killed 70 people just in the last few days on the edge of Baghouz. Are we seeing the end of this fight with ISIS? Once this village is, I hate to use the word, but I will anyway, is pacified, is it over?
Not quite. There are other pockets of ISIS in the government-held territory. In the vast Syrian Badia or eastern desert, there are bands of loosely organized ISIS remnants. I'm not sure if they even control a single village, but there are bands of them still on the loose. But of course, in Western eyes, they don't count. Trump will announce, we have dealt with, we have annihilated ISIS. By his interpretation, the term Syria just means that like 30%, which is U.S. control, the rest doesn't count.
Mm-hmm. And that's the way it seems to be playing out. I want to ask you also about Israel. The Israelis show no compunction about attacking Syria on Syrian territory. They launch airstrikes. They launch missile strikes. Is this going to turn into the next front?
No, I don't think so. This has been going on and off for quite some time. I'm not sure this latest flurry represents anything very new. Remember, we're in a pre-election period in Israel. This sounds like Netanyahu flexing his muscles, showing that he's the best military leader. And he faces a serious military leader, a general. So he's brushing up his military credentials, trying to ramp up the crisis atmosphere in which he tends to flourish, ramping up the Iran threat. I suspect there's a big element of this going on here, and I don't think the Iranians and their allies like Hezbollah will be stupid enough to play into Netanyahu's game by overreacting.
Yeah, I'm wondering too exactly what the U.S. strategy is, because we've got the president's announcement. Well, he's essentially declared victory and decided to pull the troops home. Congress is furious about it, but it remains to be seen what they're willing to do in order to keep troops in Syria beyond just a token force. In the event that the U.S. actually does withdraw troops, how does that change the situation on the ground there? Or does it even change the situation on the ground?
It changes the situation to a very small extent. 2,000 troops are really neither here nor there in the big picture, in the military equation of the numbers of forces engaged in that theater. They're a tripwire. They're a tripwire. Their presence means that if Iran, Assad, Russia, or Turkey, if you come near our guys, we're going to bring in the Air Force. It's the Air Force that really counts in strategic terms. The troops are just a tripwire. And as one of the U.S. generals has said in the last 2-3 days, this is not going to change with the withdrawal of troops. It appears that there is still an intention to exercise some kind of control over the territories via the U.S. Air Force.
We haven't had a chance to talk about Turkey. There was a truck bomb along the border with Turkey just a couple of days ago that the Associated Press has reported on. There was no word on casualties, but we're seeing less and less, I think, or fewer and fewer, I should say, attacks along the Turkish border. Why is that? Is it because the Turks have done what they said they would do and they've pushed their opponents deeper into Syrian territory?
No, I don't think the Turks have done what they were supposed to do. On the contrary, HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, that's the most radical al-Qaeda-affiliated armed group, has taken control of probably 70-80% of Idlib. This was not supposed to happen on the terms of the Sochi agreement that Turks negotiated with the Russians and which ensured the Russians and Assad would not themselves advance on Idlib. The Turks have not respected the terms, and now they're in intensive discussions with the Russians on what to do about it. There's an upcoming summit, I believe, between Erdogan and Putin, and maybe Rouhani is going to be involved as well in the coming days. So this situation is very fluid up there. And, you know, which party was responsible for the car bomb? Again, there are several candidates. This could be HTS demonstrating to the Turks that attacking them or trying to bring them to heel could be very costly.
Ambassador, in our last minute and a half, talk a little bit about peace negotiations. We've had talks in Sochi. We've had talks in Geneva. Has anything actually stuck? Is there really a chance for a negotiated peace?
No. Almost alone in saying that the only solution can be a military solution. Even the Russians and the Iranians pay lip service to this convenient fiction that in the end there can only be a political solution. Look, what we have on the ground already is a military solution. Assad has clawed back control over the great majority of the country. And the remaining pockets, too, will in due time be clawed back by military means. There may be some negotiations with the Kurds. These are ongoing at the moment. But then the Kurds have never actually fought Assad. There have never been any significant battles between the Kurdish forces, which have never actively sought to separate from Syria. They just want a bit more local self-control. So, yeah, there could be a political solution for that corner of Syria. But overall, and there's no way to negotiate with HTS to get back control over Idlib. The solution can only be their military annihilation.
I think you're exactly right. That was the voice of Ambassador Peter Ford, who joined us from the United Kingdom. He's the former UK ambassador to Syria. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly segment dealing with the ongoing militarization of space. As the U.S. continues to withdraw from international arms treaties, will the weaponization and militarization of space bring the world closer to catastrophe? We're joined from Old Westbury, New York by Professor Carl Grossman. He's a full professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. He's also the author of 6 books and the host of a nationally aired television program focused on environmental, energy, and space issues. Welcome back, Professor Grossman.
A pleasure.
So tell us what's new in the world of space and militarization today. The Pentagon has been active in the past week or so, has it not?
Well, Space News, which is the major trade journal involving space issues, just out a headline of its very lengthy article, Pentagon Budget Proposal Funds Space Force Headquarters as a, and this is important, it's right from an official government document, a starting point. And what the article says is that, well, the U.S. is moving in terms of turning the heavens into a war zone in a three-pronged way. They would set up a space development agency. They would create a U.S. Space Command. And further, they would lay the foundation for the headquarters of a space force. And in the 2020 budget request of the Defense Department, they're asking for $270 million in fiscal year 2020 to do this. And a lot of this is contingent on that Space Force, that U.S. Space Force thing that Trump has been promoting, a separate U.S. military armed force. We would have the Air Force, the Navy, the Army, the Marines, and then a Space Force. Clearly, the Trump administration is moving ahead very feverishly on this. And the big issue is whether Congress, now with the Democratic majority, will support having a separate and new arm of the U.S. military called the Space Force to essentially make war in the heavens.
Brian, it's still unclear exactly what this Space Force is supposed to do. The Canadians made a very odd announcement a week ago saying, well, if the Americans are going to have a Space Force, we should have a Space Force too. And like the United States, the Canadians never said what the heck their Space Force is supposed to be doing. Now, you know what's going to happen next. The Russians, the Chinese, the Israelis, the French, the Iranians, everybody's going to be talking about a Space Force. And the next thing you know, space is militarized. Of course, it already is, but it's even more militarized. It's even more dangerous. And we're at greater risk of something terrible happening by accident.
Yeah, that's an important point. Dr. Grossman, you know, what John is, something that John just said really makes me want to ask you this. In some ways, space is already militarized or used for military purposes. But is this a matter of quantity turning into quality? In other words, where the U.S. government is now selecting a space force, naming it, going to have a headquarters, going to have a lot of budgeting. As John Kiriakou was saying, other countries undoubtedly will follow suit. Is this a point of qualitative shift, something really profoundly new?
Well, the big issue here, the big difference is between militarizing space. And as you say, I mean, there's satellites up there collecting intelligence, been going on for decades, and weaponizing space. To deploy weapons in space, to prepare to fight in space, and so forth. And that was supposedly, cut short by the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which sets forth space as a global commons for peaceful purposes. People have probably heard that term with regard to space, space for peace, space for peaceful purposes. And the Outer Space Treaty prohibits the placement of weapons of mass destruction in space and so forth. Now with this Space Force, the U.S. is getting set to weaponize space. And in terms of that provision in the Outer Space Treaty, a key provision, no weapons of mass destruction in space. Let me just read another headline, and this is from SF Gate, San Francisco Gate. Pence leaves open the possibility of nuclear weapons in space. And this is from back in October. Vice President Mike Pence on Tuesday declined to rule out the idea of deploying nuclear weapons in space, saying the current ban on their use is in the interest of every nation, but the issue should be decided on, quote, the principle that peace comes through strength. So that provision in the Outer Space Treaty saying no weapons of mass destruction in space, clearly the Trump administration is not into that. And as you say, other nations will follow the U.S. lead. And this is some terrible lead. If the U.S. moves to weaponize space, a la Star Wars of the Reagan era and schemes even before that, you got to anticipate that China will be up there with weapons, and Russia will be up there with weapons, and India will be there with, and Pakistan will be up, and Israel will be up there, and so forth and so on. And then there's no going back. This isn't something we could, if we open this space nuclear Pandora's box. It's open. The box is open, and there's no return.
It's just amazing when you think about it. The dinosaurs went extinct because because the planet was struck by a huge meteor, right?
Yeah,
and then that was followed by a huge tsunami. Now we're going to put nuclear weapons in outer space. What's the likelihood of an accident happening?
Yeah, what could possibly go wrong?
I've written an awful lot about what can go wrong and does go wrong in regards to space. And I began doing a lot of writing about that after the Challenger, the space shuttle, underwent, it blew up in 1986. And I started, and its next mission was to bring up into orbit a plutonium-fueled space probe, which was to send on further into space. And I used the Freedom of Information Act to ask the Department of Energy, NASA, various national nuclear laboratories involved in this, about, what would occur if that accident, which occurred in January, would have occurred on Challenger's next mission in May. And then in doing the research, I got into this isn't the sky is falling issue in terms of nuclear in space, in terms of these space probe shots. And years ago, they used plutonium on satellites. There have been accidents both in our space program, the U.S. space program, and the Soviet Union, now Russia. I mean, just take launches. One out of 100 chemical launches of rockets end up with the rockets blowing up or otherwise suffering a serious mishap. So space is, I've heard NASA officials describe space as a very dangerous environment. Yeah, it is dangerous, and you got to give it to those astronauts who go up there and risk their lives. But here we're risking, with nuclear in space, the lives of the population of the planet. And we're not volunteers. And if you're going to weaponize space, if you're going to throw, the schemes through the years of the United States deploy on battle platforms, this is the basis of what was Reagan's Star Wars, hypervelocity guns, particle beams, and laser weapons. You throw those kinds of lethal weapons up into space, and then have to expect other countries will follow suit. I mean, one of the things that Trump has stressed in recent months is that we want to dominate space. We want to control space. Other nations on this planet are just not going to let this happen. And I've traveled the world. In fact, I've been to the Space Museum in Moscow. The Soviets and now Russia, highly proficient in space, but they've abided by, along with China, and the world in general, the Outer Space Treaty and this concept of let's not open space for war. I mean, we got enough troubles on this planet with conflict. Let's not expand it.
Carl Grossman, we have 1 minute left, just 60 seconds. I'm looking at a story from yesterday in the same publication, Space News. Defense Intelligence Agency report aims to educate public on space security. So now we're going to have a big PR campaign to tell us, to tell the public, to tell we the people that this is not only good, but it's absolutely necessary for safety. I mean, the irony of ironies. Anyway, now we have 40 seconds. Go ahead.
Well, people need to be educated, and go, folks, listening to the website of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. It's the lead organization seeking to stop this madness. The coordinator is a wonderful guy named Bruce Gagnon, a seasoned organizer. They hold every year conferences around the world. It is truly a global network. Go to that website, space4peace.org, www.space4peace.org, and get the real truth, not the baloney from the U.S. government.
Well, that was the voice of Professor Carl Grossman, who joined us from Old Westbury, New York. He is a full professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. He's also the author of 6 books and the host of a nationally aired television program focused on environmental, energy, and space issues. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. A dozen leaders of Catalonia's failed 2017 independence bid have gone on trial in Madrid on charges that include rebellion and sedition. One of them even faces up to 25 years in prison. The semi-autonomous region held an independence referendum on October 1st, 2017, and declared its independence from Spain weeks later. We're joined from Barcelona by Dick Nichols, the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly, and Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek joins us here in the studio. Welcome to both of you.
Happy to be here.
Nice to be here.
Dick, this trial is monumental in Spain. It's being covered live on television and radio. And public opinion polls say that Spaniards are split, that maybe the government has gone too far with these, with the possibility of these draconian sentences. What do you think?
Well, first, it's not the government. It's not this government. This is what's, you know, what we have at the moment is a socialist party government, PSOE government. This all happened previous to this government coming in, which was earlier this year. It would, basically, this is trial has happened because the previous government of Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy decided that its friends in the senior levels of the judiciary, of the legal system, would be given the job of punishing the Catalans for daring to organise the referendum. And then, and now what's happened is the PSOE government has said, well, independence of the judiciary, there's nothing we can do about this, even though that's not true. And they could, in fact, instruct the prosecution to withdraw the case. But leave that discussion to one side. Basically, what this is occupying the whole of Spain at the moment, and yes, Spain is certainly split on this, public opinion is split, but I think it's important to register that there's a growing sentiment in the rest of Spain, even amongst people who certainly don't want to see the end of the unity of the Spanish state, that this is just going to lead nowhere. It's not leading anywhere towards a solution of the Catalan question. It's not leading towards negotiations between the Catalan governments, the Catalan government and the Spanish government, and it's just going to make things worse. A very interesting indication of that was that the right wing, the three right wing parties here, the People's Party, the former governing party, Citizens, and the outright neo-Francoist, unabashed neo-Francoist party, Vox, called a big, what they hoped was going to be a huge demonstration in Madrid in support of the flag and in support of Spanish unity. And they only got 45,000 people at this demonstration, which is a real flop. And the latest polls, which are reliable, polls with a large sample, show that the number of people who, the percentage of Spaniards who want there to be a negotiated solution to the whole Catalan issue is increasing all the time. So, yes, that's where we're at. And if this is a pressure, of course, on the judges who were appointed by the PP. This is very much a conservative bench that is hearing this. But these are people who are sensitive to pressure, both from inside Spain, but also, of course, from the European Court of Human Rights, because if they bring down a judgment that is obviously biased and obviously endorses this whole operation, this whole judicialization of the Catalan question, then it's in all likelihood will be just thrown out of court by the European Court of Human Rights. So that's where we're at.
Walter, this is even more complicated than it seems on the surface, because there are Catalonian parties that support the current left-of-center government. And in the event that one or more of those parties decides to withdraw from the governing coalition, it would force elections. Is there any chance of that actually happening in light of the trial?
Yeah, so I mean, just to take a step back for listeners in the United States, the Spanish political system, it's a parliamentary system. It has many parties, although two have been historically dominant since the end of the fascist Franco dictatorship in the 1970s. That would be the PSOE, which Dick was talking about, the Spanish Socialist Workers Party, which is, you know, a very radical sounding name, but it's like the center left party. And then there's the People's Party, which is the right wing party. But the PSOE, the center left party, which is the party of the current prime minister, Pedro Sanchez, that is, they don't have a majority in parliament, so they rely on other parties' support. The principal one is Podemos, which is the political party that came out of, you know, was basically the Spanish equivalent of the Occupy movement, you know, a grassroots protests against economic inequality and the rule of the big banks. And then they also still need the support of two regional parties in Catalonia, one left wing, one center right, to basically to have a majority, to have a functioning government. So I think there are, you know, sort of really serious political implications for this. Dick, I mean, do you think that this trial or, you know, sort of the political controversy surrounding the trial could actually lead to new elections?
Well, Sanchez is actually threatening new elections because at the moment in the Catalan parties are saying, we're not going to support your budget, Sanchez, unless you give us some real movement on the question of the Catalan statehood. And what they've proposed is a negotiating table around the question of, you know, Catalan statehood. This is can't go very far, it should be said, because so far PSOE has said they are not going to accept the right to self-determination of the Catalans, so they are not going to accept a Scottish-style referendum or a Quebec-style referendum. But the PSOE's got to at least appear to be different and to be more conciliatory, more involved in dialogue with the Catalans than the PP was. So what that entails is that the PSOE has got a blackmail they can operate. They can say to the Catalans and to the Basques too, whom they rely on, the Basque Nationalist Party, if you don't support our budget, then I will go to new elections, and there's the possibility that the triple right wing will form a majority, and then where will you be? So there's a lot of, you know, threat and bluff going on at the moment inside the coalition that supports the present government. But there's nothing automatic about this. This is all a decision that the Prime Minister can make. So even if his budget is rejected, they just continue with the previous budget, which is, you know, they prorogue the previous budget. And they just continue. So that's a political decision for him.
What's the state of the Catalan independence movement? I mean, we saw truly enormous demonstrations, you know, during the year of the independence referendum, and, you know, of course, for years and years, and in fact, decades prior to that. Is the mass movement demoralized by these trials, by these, you know, sort of draconian sentences hanging over the heads of the Catalan independence leaders? Or could this actually spark a renewal of struggle in the streets?
The second. We've got the second of the options you just mentioned there. There's a lot of discussion, debate, and tension between the various component parts of the Catalan movement, but they agree. And they agree on specific concrete actions. And so with this trial, there are four concrete actions decided upon. One is the first big thing will be next Saturday, will be a big demonstration in Barcelona. I'm certain that will be huge. Then there's, on the 21st of February, there's going to be a general strike called by the nationalist trade union, which is a minority here, but which would get support from people who are members of other trade unions, maybe the major trade unions, because there's so much outrage about this. There's a lot of outrage felt by people who are not pro-independence. I mean, I talk to a lot of different people, and my family, my in-laws, cover all sort of political positions. And the general sentiment, and it's reflected in polls, that, you know, 85% of the population, which means at least 35% of people who are not pro-independence, are outraged by this trial. So the longer this goes on, the more it is a mobilising thing. And the other mobilising force, and the other proposal or initiative, which I think is very important, is that there's going to be a demonstration for the right to decide of the Catalans and for Catalan sovereignty in Madrid in mid-March, which is, in the past, you wouldn't have done that and expected to get many people along at all. You would only have got, you know, the left who are committed to the right to self-determination of the nationalities in the Spanish state. But this trial is so everywhere. It's, you know, occupying everybody. And it's, as I said, beginning to change opinion in the rest of the Spanish state. So that will be an important demonstration.
We have just about a minute left. The last question I want to ask you is about this new political party, a relatively new political party, Vox. You know, it's, like you said, a neo-Francoist party, one that sort of openly has nostalgia for the fascist military dictatorship that ruled the country from the 30s until the 70s. I was really stunned when I saw that it was one of the three co-sponsors of that pro, you know, or anti-Catalan independence demonstration. Talk about how it's becoming more mainstreamed as a consequence of the nationalist fervor, or sort of the Spanish centralist fervor that's been developed as a consequence, or maybe as a backlash to the independence referendum.
It's become more mainstream because it poses as the people who are really hard on Catalans. We're the really consistent anti-Catalanist force. And the reason, what shows that is we are opposed to the whole autonomous structure of the Spanish state. We will get rid of the states. We will just have the Spanish state, and there will be just the Spanish nationality. So, you know, Catalonia will disappear, the Basque Country will disappear, Galicia will disappear, Asturias will disappear, the Balearic Islands, all these will disappear as administrative entities, and we will go back to the Spain we had during the dictatorship, which was central government plus 50 districts run by Gauleiters, run by, you know, satraps. And that's that to people who have voted PP. Up to now, the right wing of the PP, which was this social layer, feel that they've now got somebody, a party that more consistently represents their reactionary Spanish centralist views. And they're right, and which is why the PP is trying to win these people back by going to the right. So what this reflects, of course, is the growing radicalization and divergence between the left and the right and Democrats and the right. Democrats and the right. You can't be a Democrat and just oppose the right to self-determination. So this is a very, at bottom, a very simple fight, very big fight, but a very simple fight. And Vox is winning on the right, and the Catalan movement is growing. I think we'll recover on the left here.
We will leave it there. We were joined from Barcelona by Dick Nichols, the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly. And we were joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Dick Nichols is keeping a running blog of developments at www.greenleft.org.au. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.